So happy birthday, Cecily Strong. Anybody here who know who Cecily Strong is? Anybody here watch Saturday Night Live? She's one of the people on Saturday Night Live. James Dean makes great sausages. John Williams writes great soundtracks, including Star Wars. And Daniel Bernoulli is probably the most relevant of the Bernoulli brothers for physics. If you've ever heard of Bernoulli's principle in fluid dynamics, that is the Bernoulli, not his cheap, lazy brothers who just did other things, who are other Bernoullis. So happy Boy Scouts Day and Opera Day and Laugh and Get Rich Day. So, man, I hope that works. Anyway, there is... So I did put some things on the class website. So if you go back and look at the class website now, you'll see a few updates, like I put in slides for today and next time. I put in audio from last class, so that is there, and I'll try and keep on putting audio in after I edit it and rebalance it and shrink it a bit. And then there's a homework that is due next Thursday, so spread the word. I will send out an email to the full class through Blackboard later on just to tell everybody. But it's designing your own, you know, simple, very, very simple magnet. Just a couple of, the current comes out on one side and goes in on the other. And so what's going to happen in the middle is, well, if the current is coming out, and the current, the field goes around like that. And if the current comes in, the field goes around like that. And what happens is you end up getting, you know, almost a pure vertical field in here, almost a pure dipole in the middle of this thing, and that's why it's a long dipole magnet. This is kind of an end view, or a cross-sectional view of that magnet. And you get to do some little simple calculations, assuming that this iron is very, very permeable and stuff, and figure out whether or not, when you build this magnet, do you have to water cool it or do you have to air cool it, which is a common thing that us accelerated physicists, when we're building magnets, have to decide. It's nothing as fancy as a superconducting magnet. There's some other stuff related to those that symplecticity that we talked about last class, and relating some symplectic behaviors to Pauli matrices, which is nice, and even doing a thing like talking about what happens if you turn a beamline around. Remember, I gave you a hint last class. If you flip a beamline around and want to go from the other direction, you can generate the inverse of that N matrix very easily using S matrices. So it's kind of just writing down how these relate to S matrices. And then the last one is the fun one, where you get to follow all the stuff, the recipe that we did last class. Take the Hamiltonian, take the, I give you a vector potential, here's a vector potential, plug that into the Hamiltonian, write down Hamilton's equations and try and derive the matrix. And now this is just x and x prime and y prime. Don't worry about the z and delta, the six-dimensional stuff. That's hard, turns out, for this thing. But this is a pure longitudinal field. And you see what happens as particles come into a pure longitudinal field. Yeah, you know what happens, right? That particles tend to go around in circles, particularly light particles like electrons, and in little corkscrews, like Larmor radii, they're called. And this is, if you look at all of this, this is rotations, it's sines and cosines. It looks just like that. And this is just a mathematical way of saying, what happens as particles go through a solenoid as they start to collectively spin around the design trajectory. So you can derive that, and you can derive all of that from the vector potential there, which is cool. And the, you have to be very careful about using canonical coordinates, because the canonical momenta are now not the same as the regular momenta, because there are now transverse components to this vector potential. It's not purely longitudinal like it was for the dipole that we did. So, okay, so that's homework to play with. You can ask questions. I am available for email and bribes and things like that. The And in principle, it's due next Thursday. Come on, this is an elective graduate, you know, elective high-level undergraduate course. We're in here to have fun, so I will not hold you too strongly to the due date. Play with it and turn in what you can, and I will give it back to you as well. So any questions about that so far?
So we will. What's your favorite type of bribe?
My favorite type of bribe is usually chocolate is really good. Actually, lately, cough drops are really good because I'm fighting something. So there is, cough drops are probably better than chocolate right now. Both my body and my wife will thank you. So let's get back into this and start talking. I'm going to do this a lot. I apologize. I hope nobody gets motion sick going back and forth over these things. So what we're going to talk about now is motion through an accelerator. And we're going to start going back and visualizing this phase space again and talking about, okay, let's actually build something with all these tools we have. We have descriptions of sectional motion with various matrices that we can derive and evolve. We did one of those in a complicated way for a bending magnet, the dipole, which was kind of complicated. And we did that with Dr. Hyde earlier for a quadrupole. But the simplest thing is, okay, I got a flashlight, or I got a beam of charged particles. Just take it out and there's no fields around. Just shine it. What happens? It spreads. Hey, how you doing? So just in time for the beginning of the lecture. So any divergence the beam has, the beam tends to spread. So let's take a look at what that means in terms of phase space, so to speak. So here is an animation that I had put together. This is horizontal position and now angle of particles within this beam. This picture over here is what the beam would look like if you were actually holding up a screen and walking along with it as it was moving through this space with no field, right? It starts off being kind of a small, tight beam. And then, of course, it's, you know, because different particles have different angles, that beam blows up. Now, blowing up, you kind of got a good, you know, gut feeling for, right? But it's funny, in phase space, the beam doesn't really blow up. I remember Liouville. Liouville said the area is conserved of a group of particles there together. So it's kind of, you know, you don't expect this blow-up behavior in X and Y space, in real space, to really reflect what's happening in phase space. What's happening in phase space, you can track one of these particles. Let's track the top one. It starts off at near zero position because the beam is pretty much all bunched together at near zero at the very beginning. And then what does it do? Well, over time, it kind of just moves horizontally. It gets bigger and bigger position. It started off at zero, but it had a big angle. Okay, so that kind of makes sense. And anybody else that started near zero but had a slightly smaller angle is spreading out a bit more slowly. Makes sense. Anybody that started at zero, zero, well, I stay in the center and I have no angle, so I don't really move anywhere. I stay at zero. And then the guys with negative angles, of course, move in the opposite direction. And this is how the beam gets bigger and bigger. You can take a projection of this thing and just look at this distribution of particles in X and get, you know, the projection of this thing in X. And if you take a projection of this in Y, you get that vertical axis, that projection in Y as well. So this little animation, which is on the class website, Particle Motion Through a Drift, now you kind of got a feeling for it. It's okay, the phase space, that area, as this gets kind of becomes a longer and longer ellipse, it kind of also gets narrower and narrower, it turns out. The area does stay constant. But what's happening really to the space, if you think about it topologically or in movement through a drift, is a shear. right? The top half of the plane is getting sheared off to the positive direction. The bottom half of the plane is being sheared off in the opposite direction. Does that make sense? Does that, you know, give you a happy tummy feeling? Well, what's adrift, right? Remember, if I start off with an x and x prime, oops, and I'm multiplying them or I'm transporting them through some drift. Okay. Well, what's happening here is the x's are changing. Because you end up with an equation like x1 is equal to x0 plus x prime 0 L. But sure enough, x1 prime is equal to x0 prime. So the x prime is constant. What's that topologically then, if you look at the picture again? Well, x prime is constant, so particles can only move in horizontal lines. And x, it changes, so what's happening is there's a shear. And x actually changes, you know, at the rate that that initial x prime is. So bigger and bigger x primes are going to move faster in x, and so that space is going to shear. It really is, literally, you know, mathematically, it's called a shear. So that's fine. Okay, that gives you a feeling, and truly a gut feeling, a real picture, both in phase space and in real space, of what happens in a field-free region for a distribution of particles now that have different angles. They tend to blow up. That's great, okay? So now, what's the next thing? The next thing was quadrupoles. Yeah, sure.
So, if you have, we're talking about magnet curve, brick chamber, and then magnet curves on an entire circuit. So, if you're coming out of the magnet field, are you saying it shears? So, like, if the particle's coming around through a magnet curve and it enters a brick chamber, it shears top and bottom,
so,
or side to side?
So what I'm talking about now in terms of shear is I'm talking about actually how, like, a collection of, a distribution of particles changes. So it isn't one particle, okay? One particle, if I take this and I look at the picture in x and x prime space here, for this one particle, as it's going through some field-free region, could be, drift chambers actually usually have like electric fields in them, but well, this is just a drift. This is, by drift here, I'm being an accelerator physicist and I'm saying that B equals zero. Okay, so it's a field-free region. So don't associate this necessarily with a drift chamber from experimental physics.
Okay.
So any particle here, what's going to happen is I'm going to move, you know, if a particle starts here, it moves to a positive x direction because it's got a positive x prime by this amount, right? So essentially any point, any particle that starts off with initial conditions at this x prime zero will change its actual position by the same amount. So any particle that starts off in here, you know, will move a certain amount for that given initial x prime. A particle with a larger initial x prime will move more, and that's true for any particle, regardless of its initial x, that has that initial x prime. That's why I'm talking about this as being a shear of the space, because it really is, you know, mathematically, it's a transformation from all the points in this phase space to all the points in the new phase space, and it's still x prime, and it's still, you know, one-to-one and onto. Every point has to go to a new unique point. And how does it do that? Well, you know, we've talked about rotations before. This is a different type of linear transformation that just now changes only x and not x prime. And fundamentally, that's the most important thing to carry away, is in a field-free region, x prime, the angle doesn't change of a particle because there's no field to change its direction. But the positions do. Okay, so that's an important kind of gut thing to know. Did that answer your question, April?
First? I think I was more confusing terminology than anything else.
Okay, sure. Okay, great. Yes?
So in the drift region, when the particles blow up, is there a need to bring them back toward center?
Yeah, so we're going to get to that next,
okay.
Right? Okay, so I can't just build my accelerator, you know, by not putting any magnets there, because I'm just going to have this vacuum pipe that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger to accommodate the particles. It literally is like taking your flashlight or your laser pointer and shining it into a bright sky. There's always some intrinsic divergence. You can't make a beam that is all the particles are perfectly parallel. There always is a bit of scatter, and so there always is going to be some of this tendency for the beam to spread. And with charged particles, it's even worse than that. The particles are pushing each other away from each other because of charge issues, right? So if you were to go into like the rest frame of the particles, they'd all be looking at each other going, same charge, get away, right? So, and that space charge, we'll talk about that later on in the semester. So, okay, write down the equations for field-free region. That's kind of easy. But now you all of a sudden say, oh, we need to focus these guys. And so now we need to talk about quadrupoles and get a feeling for what happens to the phase space in these pictures. Just like the phase space of a drift is a shear, and it's changing only x and not x prime. The beautiful thing about a quadrupole, okay, well, quadrupoles, remember their matrix, at least for a quadrupole, kind of looked like something like a cosine, kind of something like a number times a sine. And I'm intentionally being, you know, a little bit casual here, at least just to give a feeling for what's going on. It kind of really did look like a rotation. And so it kind of gives you the feeling that instead of a shear, what's going to happen in this phase space as I move particles around is that particles are going to end up kind of rotating. Okay. So this was kind of a general quadrupole. What we're going to do, though, is we're going to make one simplifying assumption, and that is, remember, there was an approximation that Dr. Hyde showed you where I can assume that these things kind of, you know, KL is a constant as L goes to zero, right? So I can talk about a quadrupole that is reasonably strong, but also reasonably thin. And when I did this, we had something that looked like this in terms of that magic matrix. I think this is, I'll put in a minus one for now. Right, so here x and x prime coming out of one of these guys looks like 1, 0, minus 1 over f, where f is a focal length, 1. Remember, the dimensions of x are length, they're meters. The dimensions of x prime, well, that x prime has no units because it's how that changes with distance. It's dx ds, and both of those units cancel out. So clearly, if I'm going to get an x prime out of something that multiplies an x, I better have something that looks like 1 over a length. So that's a natural length scale, and that's a focal length of something like a magnet. What does this thing do to particles? Well, you know, 0, 0 still goes to 0, of course. On the other hand, you know, any particle that has a positive x, well, okay, this is, you know, x1 is equal to x0. In fact, x's don't change. And x1 prime is equal to x0 prime minus x0 over f. Okay. So instead, now in the drift, x changed and x prime didn't. In this thin quad, x stays constant and x prime changes, which is kind of nice. It gives me kind of a nice separability of how to affect my coordinates, looking at just drifts and thin quadrupoles. So now a thin quadrupole can be used to just change the angles of things. So I've got a beam that's diverging. Okay, the angles aren't changing, but sure as heck the positions are. It's getting bigger. And now I can put in some magnet that changes the angles and doesn't change the beam size, because it doesn't change x's for any of the individual particles, but at least it changes all the angles in a way that it makes the beam kind of reconverge and focuses it. And I can keep on doing this and build up an optical system. And this is first year optics. It's exactly the same formalism as classic light optics and things like this. So a particle here with a positive x will get a negative change in x prime. And a particle over here with a negative x, if f is positive, so let's say f is greater than 0, we'll get a positive change. And in fact, what's happening is, by gosh, you know, if I've got a bigger x, I'm going to get a bigger change in x prime. If I've got a bigger x, I'm going to get a bigger change in x prime. By gosh, this is looking like a shear 2, except it's a shear in x prime and not an x. And now the real magic fun happens. Because now you can think of starting to put these things together and having particles go through them. And what you start to see is, gosh, okay, that's a shear that way. And then if a particle hits a drift, it's a shear that way. And then if I hit the right quadrupole, that's a shear that way. And then I go to a drift, and that's a shear that way. And gosh, it feels like rotations. It feels like I could assemble something that starts to look like, you know, total motion, the collective motion of all the particles in this system being something close to circles. And something close to, you know, it's not really circles. You can parameterize it that way. But by gosh, what I've got is I've got two different optical elements. That's all I need now to be able to take my particles and kind of make them stable as I try and get them from here to there, without blowing up too big to make my accelerator too big. So here's an animation of exactly that kind of thing. And it's on the website. Whoops, wrong one. So this is a particle motion through a matched, what we call this, by the way, is this motion of kind of going through a quadrupole, going through a drift, going through a quadrupole, going through a drift. We call this system photo, and you'll understand in a second why focusing and defocusing have to alternate. We'll derive some of that formally. But just to get, you know, just to set the stage at least, here's an animation now of a group of particles moving through, and you can see the shear, you can see the drifts, the places where the particles are moving through areas where there isn't a blue line. And then there are these flips, right? And those flips are particles having, you know, kind of a flip vertically on either side, which is really just a very fast shear from top to bottom, right? But overall, what this animation has, that red line there is kind of an indication of how big the beam is horizontally. And that blue line there is kind of an indication of how big the beam is vertically. And now you see, okay, it ended on this last frame, where the beam is kind of small vertically and kind of big horizontally. And what happened in the real beam, if you were to hold up a screen and walk along with it, is that the beam is kind of, you know, getting big and horizontal, and then big and vertical, and then big and horizontal, and big and vertical. Never is there a time when the particle's positions jump. The angles might change very quickly as you're going through one of these thin quadrupoles. That's what you get. That's fine. But in reality, what's happening is, by gosh, the beam size is completely constrained within this box. It doesn't get super big anymore. So I can assemble a system that does this. And the real magic thing, and we'll get to that in a sec as well, is that you don't need to just put in focusing lenses. Remember when we built the magnets, if you were focusing in horizontal, you happen to be diverging in vertical. I can't build a real optical lens, like a real glass lens for light that focuses in all directions simultaneously with magnets. It violates Maxwell's equations. What I can do is I can build a quadrupole that focuses in one plane and defocuses in the other. And you might say, well, isn't that a losing proposition? Or at the very best, break even if I focus in one plane and then focus in the other, and then I come along and focus in the other plane, but then I undo kind of the focusing I did before. Turns out, no, you can actually win if you do it the right way. And that is a long haul to a short slide to set up today's lecture about strong focusing. And all of the formalism that we'll talk about is talking about how you do that magic trick of alternating focusing and defocusing systems to get net focusing.
So, this simulation you had, that is from Maddox?
No, that simulation I wrote in some cheap Perl code a long time ago to try and give, you know, people a visual feeling of what's really happening, because I didn't have any, there weren't any other good codes out there that really showed what I wanted to show, so I just wrote some cheat code. So now the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to talk about, okay, what happens when I have to pair up a focusing and a defocusing element? Can I get net focusing out of those two things? If I can't, I lose. On the other hand, if I can adjust the strengths and the distance between them, maybe there are some parameters where it does kind of work, and I can average out and get some net focusing. So we'll talk completely about doublets, and then we'll talk more about an analytical approach to all of this stuff, and go on probably two lectures on these things, since this lecture's almost a third of the way over already. So what we're going to do is we're going to assemble optical systems with our dipoles and quadrupoles. You can see why I covered phase space, why we covered magnets, you know, all of that kind of sets this up. And why we covered even a little bit of Liouville in those dynamics is because that phase space area is conserved as things move through these magnets. So the fundamental problem is that, okay, quadrupoles fight themselves in the opposite plane. And if I try and make a system, there is one magic type of magnet that can kind of focus in both directions, except it ends up having to defocus the beam later on, and that's a solenoid. Right? Solenoids have these field lines that come in to the solenoid, one end of the solenoid, and particles can get bent in a way that they actually do get kind of focused in both horizontal and vertical planes. But it's very weak. Almost all the field lines are kind of parallel to the particle's direction of motion. So it's not really a useful technique, particularly for high energy beams. You just can't get big enough magnetic fields and big enough solenoids to make a big accelerator with net focusing. This strong focusing idea practically never won the guys a Nobel Prize, but it should have. And one of the progenitors I used to work with at Brookhaven, and he still went to work every Wednesday when he was 92, a guy named Ernie Courant. So son of a very, very famous mathematician, also named Courant. So let's take these pieces that we have. There's the drift and the drift matrix that I wrote down. There is the thick quadrupole, which kind of looks like these cosines and sines, these rotations. But the thin quadrupole is really the building block that we'll use last class. Now, you can build, a lot of people, in fact, build sections of beamline where they just have a source. They have this straight section with lots of focusing and lots of drift areas. And then they have something that they're hitting the particles against. That's fine. But if you want to build something circular, or maybe there's a wall there, but you can only build your accelerator here, so you need to bend it around the wall somehow, you need to bend the beam at some point, and that's what the dipoles are for. And that's the matrix that we derived last time for this type of dipole. It's called a sector bend, because particles come in, the design trajectory comes in here, and the magnetic field turns on exactly perpendicular to the design trajectory. And then as it comes out over here. When you talked about weak focusing, there was an axial symmetric thing, like your Bebetron homework was just like that. Looked like kind of this constant field that was cylindrically symmetric that also had bending in it. This is the formalism for a magnet like that that bends over an angle of theta with a radius of curvature of rho. Okay, and we derived that last time. So let's write down, you know, just what happens. What's the matrix of a doublet, of a focusing lens followed by a defocusing lens with a drift between them? Because if you put them right on top of each other, not much happens. If they're the same strength, it gets kind of boring. So take these, plug them into Mathematica, or whatever your favorite symbolic algebra program is, and multiply them all out. You can already see that, gosh, this is just two magnets, and things are already starting to get kind of tedious. This is why us accelerator physicists use symbolic algebra codes or other simulation codes. We don't multiply a lot of these matrices together analytically in our notebooks. Gets to be very, very error prone if you're not careful. So let's assume that this guy really is focusing, so his focal length is greater than zero. Let's assume that this guy really is defocusing, so I wrote it without the minus sign here, and I assume that he is greater than zero then too. And this is multiplying these guys together. So what I end up with is I end up with something that's interesting. I end up with this matrix that really looks kind of like a drift in this upper right-hand term. And then this lower right-hand term, if I want to talk about it kind of like that's the focal length of something that looks like a lens, well, then I can talk about 1 over the focal length as kind of that lower left-hand term. And in fact, you know, this is a good way of doing it in regular optics, too. Approximate it and see. So let's make both of these things equal, just to simplify things out. When I do that, crunch through the math, and it turns out that there is, in fact, something that is uniquely negative definite. There really is net focusing, regardless of how big or small f is. So this is fabulous. I can make a net focusing system out of this alternating gradient stuff. And in fact, one of the first accelerators built like this was called the alternating gradient synchrotron. And the link to the paper on that is on the website. So this is a fundamental point of optics, that you can, that in fact, you know, this is a telescope, this is a microscope if you do it the other way around. This is also the building block of all accelerators, called strong focusing. So that's a little demonstration that you get that, which is fabulous. So now the question is there a constraint on these values? Can I just put any old quads together and get some focusing? Is this hand waving of, gosh, this thing is like 1 over a focal length, is that really true? Sometimes I give this as homework, but it is a nice trick to know too. So here's that matrix again for the system. And what focal length really means if I have a black box. So, okay, I have this system where I've got this doublet. Okay, let's just put a black box around it. And I say, if there's a net focusing, it kind of is going to look like a lens. So how do I figure out its focal length? Well, what I can do is I can put in, paraxial rays, right? If I put in paraxial rays into a real system like this, and this will, do some funny thing. But if I put in paraxial rays on a real lens, that's kind of the standard classic, even a kid way of measuring a focal length of a lens. Look at where the focal point is for the sun's rays or sun incoming paraxial rays. What's the equation of a paraxial ray? That's just, x prime is zero. It's got no incoming angle. It does have incoming positions. So I take that matrix and I multiply it by something with just incoming positions. And I get something like this. And now I ask, okay, where does this thing cross? Where do all of those lines cross x equals zero? Which is really, asking what the focal length is. Well, it crosses x equals zero if and only if that thing is zero for any incoming x zero. So now I can, the other thing that has to happen for this to have a focal point is that the x primes must have the opposite sign of x where the incoming paraxial ray is concerned. So, let's see, how do I explain that really quickly? I can explain that really quickly. This could also be net defocusing, right? But the real thing that happens, the fundamental point that convoluted language makes is, here I've got a positive x0. By gosh, this is a negative x1 prime. I get bent towards the axis. And by gosh, this is a negative x0. And by gosh, this is a positive x1 prime. I get bent towards the axis from where I am. So regardless of where I am coming in, I get bent towards the central axis. That's focusing, by definition. Sorry for the horrible language, but that's what it tries to say. And so if you set those two things equal, you can find out that this system has net focusing then only under the constraint that the focal length of these lenses is longer than the distance between them. If I put the lenses too close, I don't end up getting focusing again. So that's great. Not only have I determined that I can get focusing, I've determined the constraint that's necessary to get focusing. And this is also why all my quadrupoles are weak. Because this is, these are, the focal lengths have to be long compared to the length of the system between them to get this. So I don't want quadrupoles that are too strong. They'll start to violate the system and the beam will blow out of the accelerator. So now, okay, for bigger systems, so now I just assembled, one little matrix of two of these together. Well, then we can go through another one. Then we can go through another one and another one. I might need to go from here to Topeka with my accelerator and have 500,000 of these things. So I can look and I can ask, what happens to the stability of the system as I chain a bunch of these things together, as I apply those to my initial particle coordinates as n goes to infinity. And you can do some linear algebra, you can talk about eigenvectors and eigenvalues of those M matrices, which we know to be unimodular because we derived all that in a previous lecture, and they're symplectic and all of those things. So because they're unimodular, it turns out that the eigenvalues have to lie on the unit circle in the complex plane. That's a linear algebra result of this. The eigenvalues of any power of that N matrix have to be on the unit circle in the complex plane. And of course, if I'm, you know, multiplying these things out, what do I get? I get the eigenvalues multiplying the eigenvectors to some large number of powers, because I keep on multiplying them again and again and again. And so, by gosh, I better not be multiplying by something that's like e to a real number. Because e to a real number that's too big, you know, either too small a number will go to zero, but either too big a number will blow up. So those mu's, those eigenvalues now must be real. And I can, in fact, not only that, but the eigenvalues of this thing have to be complex conjugates. So I can start deriving some cool things about this general matrix now, of this complete focusing system that I'm putting together. One of the things turns out to be, since the eigenvalues look like this, I could always write some transformation that diagonalizes M and ends up putting the eigenvalues on the diagonal. Under that sort of a transformation, the trace of the matrix doesn't change. So that means that the trace of this M better be equal to the sum of those two eigenvalues. That's a general linear algebra result. So that's pretty awesome. This is an e to the I mu and an e to the minus I mu. By gosh, that looks like, you know, 2 cosine mu, if you remember your trig. So this is pretty awesome. This means now that I have a stability criterion. If mu is positive, I can write down something about the trace of this matrix, of this combination of optical elements, and it has to be within this range. So for this system, for any chain of these accelerator elements to be stable. So far, so good. That was some linear algebra relationships that relate to these general systems and asking about stability. So now there is, let's see. So let me diverge a bit and draw another couple of pictures. I talked about doublets, right? So we talked about what happens when particles go through, you know, what's necessary to keep them bounded just going through two of these, or even going through two of these times you know, n, where there are lots of these, so, you know, more and more and more of these, etc. Okay. So at some point, though, remember what I'm going to do is I'm going to start throwing in dipoles, because this thing, you know, goes off to some distant place. Instead, I'd like to build an accelerator that kind of circles back on itself. And then I'm going to need some dipoles that bend the beam around. And because I'm talking about stability of this system over a long period of time, I'm going to talk about is M now is one turn around this accelerator. Okay, so my particles start here, they go through all of that stuff and come back. And M to the N better be stable. Because my particles are going around the accelerator again and again and again and again. And so the question becomes, how do I start talking about this, not just in terms of M to the N being stable, but in terms of periodicity? Because I am going through the same magnets again and again, right? It isn't just a matrix that I'm describing with this thing, but I am going to want to know something about how the particles actually move through each of these magnets. Now, just because the particle, just because this matrix m to the n is stable, doesn't mean that the particles come back to the same spot in phase space every time they go around this accelerator. Right? They could come back just like particles going through this alternating focusing system don't come back to exactly the same spot in phase space every single time. Let's take a look and see if that's actually true for the picture that I had up here. That correlates to the tune, right? When we get to that point, that will be exactly be what it is. It's something, the frequency of particle oscillations, whoops, around the around a circular accelerator is called the tune.
And phase
advance. Huh? Phase advance, right? There was some commentary about Betatron phase advance in the previous lecture. We will get to that in these lectures now. So. There we are. Let's see. So let me shrink this up a little bit. So let's follow these particles as they move through this focusing system. And you can see this is already pretty beautifully periodic, right? This seems, at least the maximum size of the beam, seems to be extremely periodic, seems to follow exactly the periodicity of this alternating focusing system. Does the actual individual particle motion? Well, let's watch and see, right? Watch one of the particles that is kind of an outlier, right? Like that extreme red guy there. And it turns out that in this entire animation, even though the entire system makes a few let's watch it again and see. The entire system makes 1, 2, 3, 4 periods of the particle of the amplitude to maximum beam size at least. Does that guy go around 4 times? Well, not really. Comes around there, bops up there, comes back there again, but he's not coming back in exactly the same place as he was. Certainly the particle motion itself is not exactly the same, got the same period as the arrangement of the magnets. Oh yeah, I mean the green outliers, that's another good point, right? The green outlier here at least, that's right. He's moving continuously and then he kind of moves in and joins his brethren and comes out again. I should label one outlier in red in here so you can really watch it by eye. But it is truly, the individual particle motion is not following the same periodicity, which means that since the individual particle motion is not following exactly the same periodicity, well, the individual particle motion is following m's, right? The x and x prime, 1 is equal to m times x and x prime 0. So I shouldn't expect the m's to reflect fully that periodicity that I had within my lattice. So what I'm going to do, we got to matrices by looking at second order differential equations, right? By looking at practically f equals ma and breaking out initial coordinates of x and then x prime. What we're going to do is we're going to go back to the original equation, the motion that we had to derive all of this stuff, and instead write down x plus something like, a focusing. Is equal to, I think it's 0 at first at least. Let me go back to the slides and see where that is. Oops, I can never remember which one of these buttons is which. So on this equation is called Hill's equation. If you were just going through a system with constant focusing, so let's say you're going through the world's longest quadrupole and it had constant field, and there was a nice little picture of the particles kind of bouncing back and forth between they come out of that quadrupole. If they stay in the quadrupole forever, they just bounce back and forth like linear harmonic oscillators. And that is exactly what this equation is, your boring old linear harmonic oscillator equation. Well, gosh, and also, you know, I'm defocusing in the other plane, of course. But what's really happening is I'm breaking it up with areas where there's no focusing, where K is effectively zero, right? Because it's drifts. And now I've got areas, then the K flips, and there's defocusing, and the K flips back again. So this system, I can really write down, you know, as a general differential equation here of the particle motion through these quadrupoles and drifts, where now the K depends on where I am. That's it, right? And not only that, but the K depends on where I am periodically if I'm going around in a circle. So that equation, the general simple harmonic oscillator equation with a periodic focusing, is well known enough that has a name. It's called Hill's equation. And now this K is basically my quadrupole strength at a particular location. And now this K obeys a periodic boundary condition. As I go around the circumference or go through the periodicity of some lattice, it doesn't have to be the circumference of a circular accelerator. I mean, it really could be this distance in between, you know, a periodic focusing system like this. Right? As long as those magnets are just repeated iterations of the same Lego block building again and again and again, that's also a periodic focusing system, if you can see it. So I can start treating this, you know, nice and generally. It can be rings, it can be anything, any set of magnets that kind of repeat themselves over and over again. And it can be as big, like I said, as the entire accelerator, or it can be one repeated little section. So here, you know, I could talk about this thing as four of these sections building up one big accelerator, one big synchrotron there. So this is Hill's equation, and we'll go through the math to solve Hill's equation. And this is this class and next class, and working through it. It's not that hard. In fact, it's a nice trick. And as young physicists teaching you accelerator physics, I am willing to bet not many of you, hopefully with the exception of Suba, will go on to become, you know, there's professional accelerator physicists and work in the subdiscipline. But this is a cool trick for differential equations regardless of what you do in the future. So if you see a periodic differential equation like this, first thing to do is say, gosh, it looks a lot like simple harmonic oscillator. I may as well guess the simple harmonic oscillator solution and guess that some of the constants in the simple harmonic oscillator will also have to have the same periodicity. So you put in an ansatz, you put in a guess, and this quite literally is an educated guess, where you say, okay, maybe the amplitude varies with S now. Not sure if it's periodic with this with C or not yet. Maybe it is. I guess it has to be because this is an envelope of the thing. But certainly this phase, you know, as I'm going through a system, as I'm swinging back and forth and I talk about the phase of a simple harmonic oscillator growing and growing and growing over time, I mean, this phi does not have to be necessarily periodic in C. So we'll take this and we'll just plug it in. Take the first derivative, take the second derivative. Be careful to take the partials with respect to all of the things that depend with S. So you get all kinds of junk floating around. And then put it in Hill's equation. So there's X prime, there's X double prime. For those of you that are Mac users, one of my favorite programs is called LaTeX. That's how I get these pretty little equations on the screen as I write LaTeX, and then at night gives me a graphic to put in my slides. So now, these things better be independent of the initial coordinate here, right, of some phi zero. This envelope, or this amplitude, the S dependence of the amplitude and the S dependence of the phase, at least. So these sine terms and these cosine terms here in this equation have to vanish identically. So these coefficients have to vanish. Yay, I get to throw away the A's, and I get two nice differential equations relating, though, that envelope and the phase and their dependence on things. And one of them works out to be a total derivative of W squared phi prime of all weird things, if you've worked that out. And so you can actually integrate that and throw away the constant and get some relationship of how the phase changes to the strength, some constant k divided by that amplitude function squared. So this actually tells you right away kind of how this is a constant, this is dependence on S. So this tells you how phi prime depends on S, right? And then there's a second differential equation which actually looks kind of complicated, at least. But there's a nice parameterization for it. This gets to, if you've talked with accelerator physicists, we call them two different things because we never can agree. They're either called Courant-Snyder parameters. It's in the original strong focusing paper. It's on the class website. These terms were used and defined originally. And even before then, talking about these types of systems, there was a person, a guy, named Twiss. And the name Twiss parameters comes from somebody's name. And they're also referred to some people like that. So I can take these two solutions and I can write down some new parameters that have a more physical, kind of intuitive connection to what's going on. What doesn't really matter is the amplitude. What really matters is kind of how big the amplitude is. So W squared is really a more kind of accessible thing, just like W squared appears in here. So I define some parameter that is this thing. So phi prime is now 1 over this beta. And that beta does explicitly depend on the S coordinate. And if I integrate this and throw away the constant, this tells me, you know, how I can calculate, if I know this beta, or I know W, I can calculate the phase. And then there's a differential equation. This differential equation gets simplified if I use this parameterization. And it ends up being this nice little thing where this k depends on s, this beta depends on s, this gamma depends on s, and it's this complicated weird thing, and this alpha prime depends on s. It's the derivative of this thing with respect to s as well. One of the beautiful things is that because w was periodic in c, well, beta must be periodic in c because that's its only s dependence. Alpha, it's just like beta, it's the derivative of beta, so it must also be periodic, and so is gamma. So these Twiss parameters, or Courant-Snyder parameters, are periodic. They truly do define some magic set of quantities that are periodic about my periodic accelerator lattice. And then the phase, of course, because it's this integral kind of as I go around the accelerator with time, it grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. So this is great. We've kind of gone back to our roots of a second order differential equation, this Hill's equation. We come up with a nice little parameterization, and now we're going to go back and say, oh, okay, here's this parameterization of this solution of this periodic second order differential equation. I really like matrices, though. So what does the matrix look like in terms of alphas and betas and gammas, right? What does the matrix look like for a particle going through this periodic system in terms of these things? Well, okay, I can write out now, instead of phi zero, I can just write this in terms of cosines and sines. I remember W was just the square root of beta. Beta was like W squared, right? So I can put in and absorb into these constants, A's and B's, that extra k, little k term I had from the integration in there. Those are just amplitudes. And then now the phi naught really gets broken out into the cosine-like and sine-like behavior of these things. So let's talk about particle position being written down, the solution of this equation being written down in this general form. I take a derivative. I end up getting alphas, which are like the derivatives of beta. I end up getting derivatives of phi in there as well, et cetera, et cetera. So it does end up being algebraically messy. But now I can do the same thing I did before, right? I can invert this and solve for A and B in terms of initial initial conditions if I put in S equals 0. So, and then say that this term has to vanish identically for any, and that this term has to vanish identically as well. And if I do that, I can write down in terms of these initial coordinates what the A's and B's have to be, so I can plug those back in. And I can finally, through a long haul to a short slide, write down a rather beautiful matrix that generally describes propagation through one of these stable periodic focusing systems. This is going one cycle now, one period through the system. So from the middle of one focusing quadrupole to the next periodic focusing quadrupole, or once around the accelerator ring, is also periodic. Right? So using those boundary conditions and writing this down at least, I define this now is exactly what Suba was talking about. This is called a betatron phase. In fact, this kind of original phase in here, these are betatron phases too. These are like phases of our particle's simple harmonic oscillation moving through the system. And for a ring, just like you asked before, if this were describing motion through one revolution of RIC or of some AGS or some ring accelerator, these are the tunes, the mus.
So it relates to the tune the same way we learned in the beta
form. That's correct. So this equation is now only for going through one period of the system, right? This isn't truly general, but by gosh, this is kind of cool that it doesn't depend. It only depends on the alphas, betas, and gammas at that point that you're looking at, and this magic phase advance thing, which is the integral around one revolution through the system of ds over beta. This phase advance either per cell or per revolution, which is the tune.
So when we talk in general about phase advance for an accelerator, the number in here is for the whole machine.
It depends on what it really depends. I mean, very often people talk about phase advances between individual elements because they're like wiggling something here. So if you wiggle something, generally if you change a magnet, what you're doing is you're changing the angles of particles. You're not changing particles' positions at that magnet. You're changing a field which changes the way that they're focused or changes the way that they're steered, changes angles. And generally what you observe is positions. So for the most part, everybody worries about this kind of upper right-hand term because that is the term that by and large is a good observable. Twiddle a magnet, change the X primes at one location, some location later on, or one revolution around the accelerator here, or one period, measure a position. X prime going into X is that guy. And it's related to that beta function, and it's related to the sign of some phase advance. So when people talk about phase advances, sometimes they're talking about, oh, I really need a 90-degree phase advance because I don't want this thing to be zero, right? If I have a periodic system where I've constructed things so that phase advance is 180 degrees or 0 degrees, I'm screwed. I can't get any good measurement of position based on some change in angle between those two guys. So we'll go into, let's see, more of this, but let me end on this slide, because this slide gets back to hop up and down dynamic stuff that I love to talk about. This thing, okay, this system that I've built, this I'm integrating something that certainly changes throughout the system as I go through the system. This went over this beta function. But this mu, this phase advance, is kind of a global thing. For the ring, it is a number. And then you got one horizontally and you got one vertically. It's doesn't depend, you know, if I calculate that number starting at one location. So let's say I've got my accelerator. Let's say I've got a ring accelerator here. And what I do is I calculate, by multiplying all the matrices together painfully, I calculate the M matrix at this location S0. Okay? So I do that, and what I end up with is I end up with, you know, some matrix that looked like this thing, this cosine mu, plus, and now it's an alpha S0 sine mu, and a beta of S0 sine mu is up here, and then other stuff down below as well. Okay, the thing I'm pointing out is that this mu that I calculate in here that have those sines and cosines doesn't depend on where I chose to calculate this. The alphas and betas do, but the mu doesn't. So if I were to take this same system and instead, you know, calculate this M here and call this S1, okay, I would end up getting the same exact mu, but I would end up getting a different, quite possibly different betas and alphas, because those depend on where I chose that point to do the periodicity calculation. But that phase advance is a global property of the system, right? That mu.
So for a machine, then we would start the alphas and betas from the start of the injection, then.
If you're not just looking at a perfectly periodic system, I mean, quite often people start where the beam starts and end up where the beam ends if you're just going from here to there. But if you're looking at a ring, you say, well, is there a privileged point in a ring? Is there a special spot where I calculate these things? Not really. You can calculate the betas and alphas by doing this and figuring them out for every point in the accelerator. And we'll do that in a little bit for a particular optical system. But the other thing that's really important to point out here is that this looks just this equation looks just like a scalar rotation again, right? The cosines look like kind of ones on the diag. The cosines are here and the sines are there, and now we've got a little shift, but it still looks like cosine sine sine cosine. It still looks rather rotation like. If you do the determinant of this thing, it's still one, as it's got to be. I multiplied a bunch of unimodular matrices to get here. And in fact, if I take this thing and I break it out, this beautiful way of writing it, right? I times cosine mu plus this kind of funny j that depends on the alphas and the betas stuff times sine of mu. Well, j, it turns out, if I square this thing, I end up getting minus I. It's kind of like the symplectic matrix. It kind of acts, again, like a different version of matrix square root of minus 1. And that means that this M, I can truly write down, this looks like Euler. This looks like e to the j mu sine, you know, j mu. I can really genuinely write down this system in the way that looks like an exponential of a matrix. And that's truly kind of brilliant and powerful, and we'll get to ways to exploit that next lecture, or the lecture after that. So we will stop here. That is, for reference, that is slide 15, since I had a lot of visualizations at the beginning. Homework, for those that arrived late, there is new homework posted on the website that is due next Thursday about magnet stuff.